Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Goals on Film, Edge of the Crowd's dedicated sports movies podcast. I'm your host, Jason, and I've got Stewie and Dan joining me today. How are the both of you?
Good, thanks, mate. Excited to get into this one. You know, we've had a couple of weeks of good movies, so let's keep this streak going.
Yeah, it's nice to be back. It's nice to be talking about movies, about some of my favorite sports and some of my favorite movies. So I'm in a great mood, to be honest.
Very good to hear. Well, this week we are taking a look at 1999 American football drama, Any Given Sunday. The film follows the ups and downs of an American football team, the Miami Sharks, led by Tony D'Ambro, coming into the end of the season, suffering a fourth straight defeat and the loss of two quarterbacks in the same game. A third string quarterback, Willie Beeman, is given a chance to perform and takes the team into the playoffs. Before the first game of the playoffs, after a rousing speech from D'Ambro, the Sharks take the field. Cap Rooney, who was one of the quarterbacks who was originally injured before, comes back into the position but gets concussed, prompting Beeman to become the next in line. Beeman apologizes to his teammates for his previous actions and leads the team to a win. In a post-game talk with D'Ambro, he dedicates the next game to Cap Rooney but admits that he is worried about his ongoing health. In the epilogue, we get a voiceover that says that the Sharks did eventually lose the championship game to San Francisco, and at D'Amato's press conference as head coach, he is thanked by the team. He's expected to announce his retirement, but he instead drops a couple of bombshells that he's been hired as the next coach and general manager of an expansion team, the Albuquerque Aztecs, and that he has signed Willie Beeman to be his starting quarterback and franchise player. With all that in mind, and obviously having watched the movie, what are your two thoughts on it? Stewie, we'll go to you first.
I thought the movie was good. Just good, though, not great. I thought it went a little bit too long, and I know Dan's got some of the same thoughts as me, so I won't step on too much of, you know, what he's got to say too, but, yeah, maybe I'll just leave it at that. Dan, why don't you fill in the blanks for us, mate?
For me, this was one of those movies that just didn't live up to its potential, because we had actually all the ingredients for what could have been a classic: a leading man with an incredible power speech in the locker room. And this won't be the first or last time that we mention the power speeches on podcasts. But we had a story that isn't just your standard underdog gets up, smashes it, you know, fairy tale. Like, we have a character who really has lots of flaws and isn't necessarily your typical hero. He's almost the villain at times. But it does feel like there is too much football. And for anyone who's a long-suffering New York Giants or New York Jets fan, too much bad football, which you're quite used to. Because I don't think the football scenes are that great in this movie, which is a hot take. And there's a fair few too many of them. So for me, it had all the ingredients to be an absolute classic and just doesn't quite deliver.
Yeah, I think that I agree. I think that there was potentially too much football. And I was saying to you both off mic as well, when we first got sort of our original thoughts on it, that I thought that the sort of like pacing of it was, you know, it was fast and it was like frantic at some places throughout the movie. And like, especially at the start too. And then like it was slowed down and sort of like, you know, came to like a standstill at points as well. But I think like part of that pacing, and like, I think a lot of the scenes as well, you know, they weren't sort of like drawn out so much. And like, you know, you weren't like there within like a scene for too long, like, you know, moved along really nicely. But I think that, you know, coming back to your point about there being potentially too much football, I think like that might have been drawn out and sort of like taken away from other parts of the story maybe. But in saying that, and I know that we'll definitely get to talking about like the depiction of the sport later on as well, I thought that you know, like the film, when it needed to feel sort of like rushed, you know, it also felt slow at the same time as well. I think that, you know, there were some emotional scenes in it. I think like, you know, sort of understood the degree of like the game and like the feelings that were being sort of like felt and expressed throughout a certain moment. And yeah, like that's sort of like what I sort of took away from it. I think that it was potentially a little bit too long, as a overall movie as well. But I think that, everything sort of came together, despite that at the same time.
I'd just like to add that some of it was like a little bit ahead of its time with the concussion painkillers subplot too.
He needs an MRI.
You're not here 6 months, Ollie. You're gonna order a $20,000 workup for every nutcase on his team. Come on.
He could have a subdural hematoma, intracranial bleeding.
Or he could just be a crazy fucker, okay? Listen, they all walk on that field every Sunday. They got only one thing, and one thing alone going for them, their confidence. You start chipping away at that with a bunch of unnecessary testing, and we can just kiss the playoffs goodbye.
Are you saying that I can't do the tests on Shark?
What about Shark?
He's woozy still. He's got bad migraines, post-concussive syndrome. Cross your arms. Don't get a hard on. Don't move.
Can you clear him?
Christina, the guy's had 3 concussions in 5 months. There's just no way to predict what another head hit would do to this guy. Look, I don't think anything's going to happen, but I'm not a complete prick, you know? I do have some kind of conscience, all right?
I'm not trying to screw him, Harvey, but I'd like to have him in the playoffs.
Look, long term, what are you thinking?
What am I thinking? Bottom line, we'll cut him in the off season. The word's out, everyone's seen him take the hits. Nobody's gonna sign a $2 million concussion case. He'll be happy to have his job back at 30% of what he makes. That's if we want him back.
He's got 4 kids, Christina.
You do the math, doctor. What you help save us now, we won't forget a contract time.
Well, it's hard to predict this kind of thing, but what I can say is that the wrong kind of hit could result in paralysis, seizures, even sudden death.
What else is new?
In my opinion, he is not medically fit to play.
Coach, you need me against Texas, don't you? Don't you?
Of course I need you against Texas, but not at this price, no.
You have to sign a waiver, Shark.
Bring it on, man. Bring it on.
Coach, we need to have a discussion about Harvey.
You evil motherfucker! Come over here.
What?
Shark's Phil. I know what you did, asshole. You switched the results so Powers wouldn't pick up on it, didn't you?
Princess, I'm going to call you right back, okay? Granted, it could look that way to a layperson, Tony, but these tests...
I want you out of here now. Okay. Come on.
You're taking the high road, is that it?
Here, you didn't even consult with him. He could get killed out there. You didn't consult with him?
I'm going to consult with a player. What are you talking about? I knew his answer. And getting killed, what, maybe, maybe not. One chance in 1,000. But hey, nobody blitzes like the Shark, right, Tony?
So, you know, they are really good, smart, ahead of its time, insightful stuff in this movie. But, yeah, I'd just like to echo both... too long and too much football, and to Dan's point, it had all the ingredients to just be this incredible movie. All-star cast, the inches speech, it had it all, and Oliver Stone kind of screwed the pooch on this one, I think.
And I think it's interesting, you know, it's funny that we talk about it this week. It's heading into week 7 of the NFL, but a couple of weeks ago, we had a situation where we had a team lose 2 quarterbacks in 1 game. It was the New England Patriots. They lost Mac Jones and then Brian Hoyer, who's the starter and the backup, in 1 go. And we found this rookie, Bailey Zappi, who went out and didn't win the game because he was up against Aaron Rodgers, who is, you know, one of the 5 best quarterbacks of all time, but has since been good enough to start a quarterback controversy about who should be the starter. And so I think it's really interesting that we're talking about this movie this week when in Boston and in corners of New England, they're talking about this situation where you've got a starter coming back from an injury and the backup coming back from a concussion. And you're like, do we like our 3rd stringer best? Maybe.
imitating life, imitating art, imitating life. It's yeah. That's incredible.
Maybe the next segment shouldn't be references to history. It should be like what this movie predicted 20 or 22 years on.
Well, hang on. If we're going to do that, then we need to dedicate an episode to The Simpsons. That's been a future-looking show for a long time.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, I just want to like continue one of your points as well, Stewie, about like how this movie was potentially ahead of its time as well. And I think it's interesting to note like the way that they sort of like went about, you know, creating this movie in the first place as well. And I know that there are a couple of people, you know, including Oliver Stone, who wrote, directed, produced this movie. Jamie Williams, who was a former NFL tight end, he was a technical consultant on it. And part of their discussion about the movie was, you know, black people coming up to be like a quarterback or like not really considering or being considered for that position. And so like they all thought that it was sort of a great script idea, an idea to integrate into the movie as well. And, you know, just look at like the sort of the treatment of that and how you would capture that and, you know, telling it through the eyes of someone like that as well. And so I think that, you know, as you said, like being ahead of the game or ahead of, you know, movies as well to explore this idea of black quarterback and obviously Willie Beeman in the actual movie as well, like, you know, that they sort of like saw this as an opportunity to tell a story like this in this particular way through the movie.
Yeah, I thought that some of that was a little bit ham-fisted, the way they portrayed it in this movie. Like, I don't think it was developed enough. I think they kind of spring it on you a little bit. You get the speech, the dinner speech, and Al Pacino's characters that really draws it home.
You can feed the press and the fans that whole sacrifice and glory of the game crap, you do it well. But I've been there. I've seen a long line of coaches just like you all the way from college with that same old bullshit halftime speech.
Bullshit.
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Yes, it's bullshit. You know what, you know it's bullshit because it's about the money. Raking in the TV contracts, fat cat boosters sitting in the skyboxes, the coaches trying to up their salaries, and the whole time, what you looking for? You looking for the next black stud to take it to the top 10. Get you in a bowl game. It's the same way in the pros. Except in the pros, the field hands get paid.
Come on, don't play that race card on me, kid. 25 years I work with men of your color.
Maybe it's not racism, maybe it's placism. Brother has to know his place, right, boss?
I don't understand what you're talking. What are you talking about? You don't trust anybody because of what happened to you in college? Come on, Willie. You knew the rules.
But other than that, it's I guess it's almost subtext throughout the movie. Yeah. I didn't think that was handled well, but it is it was its time and that it decided to tackle, I suppose.
I have to be a big fan of Jamie Foxx's, but one of his failings is that he's not big on nuance and subtlety. And it felt that subplot was kind of handled in that way, as Stewie said. Kind of quite typical Jamie Foxx, blunt and verbal and open, which is brilliant, but it's not subtle or nuanced, and it probably needed a little of that.
Absolutely. A steaming hot take on Matt last time. I'm glad to hear that we're on the same page then.
All right, we'll move on now and we will look at references to history. And the first thing that we might touch on is the connection or lack of connection to the National Football League itself. And so director Oliver Stone tried and failed to get the NFL's permission to use real team logos and stadiums for the film. Bad weather and a threatened lawsuit by the NFL, who didn't take kindly to the way the game was played or depicted in the original script, meant the production was delayed for 8 months. When the NFL refused to assist the film in any way, the fictional league was used instead and imagined as a more successful version of both the World Football League and United States Football League, who both challenged the NFL in the 1970s and 1980s, but did not last long. As a result, the fictional Associated Football Franchises of America, the AFFA, was created, and it apparently exists alongside the NFL, though, because the Miami Dolphins are mentioned, and Dallas's championship banners are seen in one of the scenes at towards the end as well. So they sort of, yeah, go hand in hand in terms of living in the same timeline, I guess. But yeah, the screenplay does make have one scene where the mayor of Miami tells Cameron Diaz's character that one of the reasons the city cannot afford to build a new stadium for the Sharks is the local prominence of the Miami Dolphins. And yeah, so I think it's really interesting to note that the NFL didn't have didn't give this film permission to use any of their team names, logos, or stadiums. But Dan, you have a bit of a comparison between this one and a movie that the NFL did allow them to use all this stuff.
Yeah, and I was talking about off air the fact that draft day, which we talked about, I'm going to say 6 weeks ago, but was actually closer to like 4 months ago. was so unique because not only did the NFL kind of endorse it in terms of allowing for logos and team names, things like that, but they used facilities. They had Roger Goodell actually making, you know, appearances and part of it. And it's really striking when you look at that compared to, you know, any given Sunday is a really good example, but really every other football movie that you can think of that is pro football doesn't have the same NFL rights. And one example is Concussion, where they really skirt around the NFL branding incredibly tightly. And so it is kind of quite striking. And for me, that was one of the things. It's like, because the NFL is so dominant, it's not like something like Ted Lasso, where you can kind of picture AFC Richmond playing third division or something. This is, that there has never been a successful competitor to the NFL. So anyone that's not NFL that has these big packed out stadiums and these huge, you know, glitzy lifestyles is, it feels a little bit artificial, I think. And I know that that's me, you know, not being able to suspend the reasonable belief for the sake of the art, but it is something that I kind of note on this one.
Yeah, there's a couple actually of great oral histories about the making of this movie, and they discussed with Oliver Stone and the other guy who you mentioned before, Jason, whose name I can't remember, the former NFL player, and a whole bunch of the cast and stuff, and they actually go into the licensing side of things, and the NFL was so dead against having anything to do with this movie that they actually sent faxes, I think, to all the teams saying, do not under any circumstances have anything to do with this movie. Not all the teams acquiesced to the NFL's request, but from memory, and of course, as anyone who listens to this podcast regularly will tell you that my memory is terrible, San Francisco 49ers were definitely one of the teams that that helped out, and so were the Dallas Cowboys. And there was one other team too, but that escapes me at the moment. So I think the themes of the movie, I mean, Dan put it perfectly, like it's hard to find a pro football movie that does actually have NFL licensing other than Draft Day. But I think just the way football is depicted, football players, I guess, more specifically, the way the medical teams are depicted, I don't think it's much of a surprise that the NFL didn't want to have anything to do with it, you know?
Yeah, the one example that I have in terms of like the NFL actively sort of attempting to prevent players from taking part in the project is and you mentioned the team before too, San Francisco 49ers, their wide receiver Terrell Owens can be seen playing and scoring two touchdowns for the Sharks. And the name on the back of his jersey is actually Owens as well, but he wears number 82 compared to wearing number 81 in real life. So got around it a bit that way.
I mean, you guys maybe aren't quite so versed in the history that is Terrell Owens, but Terrell Owens is a bit of a maverick and a bit of a legend. He's obviously one of the greatest wide receivers in NFL history, but he did run through a bunch of teams because he did kind of at times do what was best for T.O. rather than what might have been best for a team, including at one point when he was benched, having a press conference and workout session in his driveway for the press because he'd been banned from the team facility. So if there was ever going to be an NFL player who went, here's my middle finger to the NFL's rules about not appearing in the movie, T.O. would have been really high on my list.
Makes complete sense then. We've mentioned this a couple of times. Al Pacino's final rallying speech for the team before the playoff game.
I don't know what to say, really. 3 minutes till the biggest battle of our professional lives all comes down to today. Either we heal as a team or we're going to crumble. Inch by inch, play by play, till we're finished. We're in hell right now, gentlemen. Believe me. And we can stay here, get the shit kicked out of us, or we can fight our way back into the light. We can climb out of hell. 1 inch at a time. Now, I can't do it for you. I'm too old. I look around, I see these young faces, and I think, I mean, I made every wrong choice a middle-aged man can make. I pissed away all my money, believe it or not. I chased off anyone who's ever loved me. And lately, I can't even stand the face I see in a mirror. You know, when you get old in life, things get taken from you. I mean, that's part of life. But you only learn that when you start losing stuff. You find out life's a game of inches. So is football. Because in either game, life or football, the margin for error is so small. I mean, one half a step too late or too early, and you don't quite make it. One half second too slow, too fast, you don't quite catch it. The inches we need are everywhere around us.
Hell yeah.
They're in every break of the game, every minute, every second. On this team, we fight for that inch. On this team, we tear ourselves and everyone else around us to pieces for that inch. We claw with our fingernails for that inch. Because we know when we add up all those inches, that's gonna make the f***ing difference between winning and losing. Fight. It's the guy who's willing to die who's gonna win that itch. And I know if I'm gonna have any life anymore, it's because I'm still willing to fight and die for that itch. Because that's what living is. The 6 inches in front of your face. Now, I can't make you do it. You gotta look at the guy next to you. Look into his eyes. Now, I think you're gonna see a guy who will go that inch with you.
Hell yeah.
You're gonna see a guy who will sacrifice himself for this team because he knows when it comes down to it, you're gonna do the same for him. That's a team, gentlemen.
Hell yeah.
And either we heal now, as a team, or we will die as individuals. That's football, guys. That's all it is. Now, what are you gonna do?
Is actually based on a real life rallying speech as well, by an NFL coach by the name of Marty Schottenheimer, who gave the Cleveland Browns a speech during the 1989 AFC Championship game. I don't have the transcript of what Schottenheimer said, or, you know, to compare it to Pacino, but that was apparently sort of a like for like, or, you know, based upon that.
That's my understanding. I certainly wasn't in any of Marty Schottenheimer's locker rooms to hear the locker room speeches, but I've heard similar sorts of things to that, Jason. And it is one of those moments that definitely kind of feels less contrived and more like it was probably just lifted verbatim from somewhere.
Yeah, maybe. The next bit of information that I have is Barry Switzer. He is the broadcaster for the playoff game in Dallas. And when a player bumps an official, he yells out, "He hit an official." When Barry Switzer was coaching the Dallas Cowboys against the San Francisco 49ers in the 1994 NFC Championship game, he was penalized himself 15 yards for bumping an official. So bit of a nod to something that he did, you know, making a comment like that from a scene in the movie.
Yeah. I think for me, the one that kind of also on that vein of the callbacks to real parts of life, Luther LaVey, who's Shark in the movie, the linebacker, is Lawrence Taylor, who was one of the greatest defenders of all time. And Lawrence Taylor was a fierce defender, but he was known, among other things, for being the defender who tackled Joe Theismann when Theismann broke his leg, which is, of course, the whole start of The Blind Side, which I'm sure we'll get to at some point. But
yeah, it's on the horizon.
kind of the injury and kind of the battle through injuries and permanent disabilities and things like that rings true. As another one of those, you know, very real callbacks.
Yeah. Well, fun fact for you, just while you've mentioned the name of Lawrence Taylor, he was voted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame during the filming of this movie. So there you go. because, yeah, he does.
Another fun fact about Lawrence Taylor, he was in the main event. He was in the main event of WrestleMania 10.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. He gets around.
We've all given Lawrence Taylor fun facts tonight.
I think that should be a regular segment in football movies. We should do a Lawrence Taylor fun fact, because let me tell you, there are enough.
All right. Looking at a character, Jack Rose, he is loosely based on sports radio talk show host Jim Rome, who was attacked by quarterback Jim Everett and apparently talks a lot of smack. Jack Rose, he's sort of like a parody of the real life reporter, who was known to be a bit over the top. And, you know, we saw this a couple of times in terms of the character's sort of reporting, the style of reporting, you know, what he said, even stuff that he was typing on his laptop. There was a scene where he's got like a Word document open and he's misspelled a couple of words as well. And so some people think that this is intentional in terms of like trying to mock know-it-all sort of sports reporters and maybe Jim Rome himself. But yeah, I think that, you know, it's cool that I guess that like they can sort of like loosely base characters on, you know, not only people involved in football in terms of like coaches and players and that, but you know that they were very open to attacking sports reporters as well.
One of the worst haircuts of all time as well on that character. Absolutely, that was a horrible do. And I am an expert on hair, so yeah.
I think for me, one of the other characters that I really like the callback on is Jim Brown, who plays Monty Monroe in the movie. And why I really like it is that, you know, he talks about how he wants to go back to high school and because the game is pure. And it's funny to me because people often talk about wanting to go back to the NFL back in the day when it was pure. And when they talk about that, they mean the age that Jim Brown dominated as the best player on the planet. There were no schemes. It was just you handed the ball to Jim Brown and you let the man score, because that's what happened. It was a pure game back then. And there's always that like little snicker in me every time he talks about that and shows that, because it's like, yeah, this is, people want to go back to Jim Brown. You know, I get that.
Just a couple to finish this one. Shark Stadium, where the fictitious Miami Sharks play, is the Orange Bowl Stadium in Miami, Florida. The home of the California Crusaders in the movie is Pro Player Stadium, where the real-life Miami Dolphins play. And obviously, we referenced the Dallas Cowboys home stadium as well. That was at the end of the movie. All right, we'll move on to our next segment, which is how well the film depicted the sport of American football. And here we might talk about how the game itself was presented, and then also, you know, the behind the scenes background stuff as well, or just like in terms of getting the right people to potentially play certain roles. And we'll obviously get into the characters themselves a bit later as well. But I think just in starting this, you know, talking about the game itself, I sort of mentioned at the top as well. I thought that, like, you know, it sort of captured the pace of, you know, what a game could be, or like the thoughts of particular players and, you know, those people on the sidelines as well, in terms of like drawing up plays, you know, like, you know, needing to make these snap decisions really fast. And, you know, just like, yeah, I think that I didn't really understand, like, until like I watched this movie, like how much is actually involved in like drawing up these plays, all the tactical stuff, who talks to who. And you know, Dan, like, maybe you can give a bit more of an insight into that as well. But like, I didn't really realize, you know, just how you know, I don't know, like how direct like everything is, like how, like, you know, how much everything needs to be like sort of pinpointed in terms of, like, yeah, as I said, like what you're drawing up, what you're wanting to execute. And so I think that, you know, it really captured that for me. You know, you got so much of that, like, frantic, as I said at the start as well, like frantic pace of the game, you know, like the camera being sort of like feeling like you're on the field, like in the thick of the action, you know, like you more so understood like what was happening throughout a particular game, and just sort of like being there. And I think that that really helped show the game itself, or the sport itself. And I know that we talked about that there were so many or perhaps too much sport in this movie, but I think that when it was shown, no matter how long it was, I think that it was done really well.
I just want to jump in, sorry Dan. Dan will take us through how accurate this was, but I just wanted to echo Jason's comments there, just about I think it's cool how it goes into, you know, the nitty-gritty of you know, everything that's involved with a game. But I think just aesthetically, the way it's shot, I mean, I think it definitely captures that, like, oh, you're on the field, you're in the thick of the action. So that's good. But then also, you know, Oliver Stone's clearly going for a certain kind of vibe with this movie, and it doesn't lend itself to great footballing scenes. So I guess just what I wanted to add is I thought it was good, but also bad at the same time. But Dan, please, you're the resident football expert here, so take it away.
I'm actually going to really agree with what Stewie said, because I think that the way that the football is depicted is quite good. You know, it's accurate, it kind of captures that, but cinematographically, it doesn't really suit, it doesn't really fit. But yeah, certainly from my understanding of what NFL games are like and what NFL sidelines are like, and, you know, I'm obviously the expert with precisely zero games experience in either of those positions. It does really seem to capture the franticness. And when you watch NFL, when you're talking about the NFL discourse these days, it's talking about coaches, you know, drawing plays up and how they manage the clock and how they manage the substitutions and all those things, and that chaos and that kind of just pure manic pressure you really do feel through these scenes. And I think that's the really good part, is that it's not, you know, we talk about things like Remember the Titans, and, you know, he's giving the rousing speech between plays, whereas in reality, you've got 40 seconds till the ball's going to be snapped at most next. You don't have time for rousing post-game speeches. You're lucky if you can get the play in before the radio cuts off and you have to take a timeout, like, let alone any other part of that. And that was really captured in the movie. And part of that's also having, you know, the right actors in the right spot. So having someone like a Jim Brown and a Lawrence Taylor, and having people who have that NFL experience so deeply involved because they really can kind of capture what it was like and make sure that what they're depicting on there is there. And, you know, I think back, we talked about Coach Carter all the way back, and that one of the things that made the basketball scenes in Coach Carter feel real is that it seemed at times like they just gave him a basketball and said, right, off you go play. And this maybe didn't have that sort of natural feeling to it, but it felt real because you had that input of the guys who did this for years and years and years at the highest level.
Yeah, for sure. The information that I found in terms of how well the film depicted the sport, one of them relates to Jamie Foxx. He stands at 5'9", apparently, and Dan, you can attest to this maybe. That seems some...
One quarterback I can think of has been 5'9 and played in the NFL at like a high level.
Okay.
One. That's it.
Okay.
It's way too short to be a quarterback, according to everyone. So that's definitely one of the, like, did they get this right?
Yeah. So apparently a New Orleans Saint quarterback, Drew Brees, is considered short for the position at 6 feet. Dennis Quaid is 6 feet. So I don't know. Maybe they were just angling for around about that sort of height for this movie, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things about Hollywood, though, is there aren't, I mean, the guys in the NFL are all 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", 6'6". Hollywood doesn't have that many actors who are 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", 6'6", to play these roles. You kind of have to just downsize people, and that's fine, I reckon.
Yeah. A couple of the other things is there's a schedule displayed after the game against the Americans, which shows 9 home and 7 away games for the Sharks' 2001 regular season, with 4 of the last 5 games being home games. Apparently the number of home games should be the same number of as away games. So wrong on that part.
Yeah. I mean, that was on a 16 game schedule, but 4 of 5 home games to finish the season seems like a great way to make sure that your third string quarterback's going to be able to win some games and get the job done to get you into the playoffs.
When Tony D'Amato addresses the locker room at the halftime, he admonishes the offense for not executing the blitz the way they practiced. The blitz is obviously, and we talked about this in We Are Marshall as well, it's a maneuver executed by the defense instead.
Yeah, to me, I always thought that this meant that he'd actually just missed a word in his script, and what he meant was blitz protection.
Oh, okay.
Which is something that the offense would do in response to, you know, a blitz by the defense. And to me, that was kind of quite plausible that he just misspoken and no one picked it up until it was way too late to cut that back in.
Speaking of cuts, and maybe we talked about it, maybe, you know, this would have helped our viewing of the film. Oliver Stone actually cut 12 minutes of football action from the European version of the film, shortening the film to 2 hours and 30 minutes, as he sort of understood that European audiences don't comprehend the rules and everything to do with American football. So he cut 12 minutes of action.
How come we didn't get the European version on Netflix in Australia?
It's incredible that Oliver Stone cut anything, to be honest. Apparently he did some...
he did salt.
The version that we saw had 20 or 30 minutes cut from it. And I mean, if you've ever seen, you know, JFK or Platoon, like, they're long movies where he garnered a reputation in Hollywood for not being too keen on the editing room. So, yeah, I guess we should be thankful that someone twisted his arm and got him to cut some. And the Europeans should be extra thankful that they got an extra 12 minutes cut.
He and Martin Scorsese must catch up for coffee from time to time.
All right, we'll move on now and we will look at the casting. And so I'll just run you through the main cast list. We had Al Pacino as Tony D'Amato, the head coach of the Miami Sharks. We had Cameron Diaz as Christina Pagliacci, the owner and general manager of the team. We had Dennis Quaid as Cap Rooney, the starting quarterback and team captain. James Woods was Dr. Harvey Mandrake, the team physician. Jamie Foxx was Willie Beeman, the third string quarterback. We had LL Cool J as J-Man, who was the starting running back. We had Lawrence Taylor as Shark, who was the starting middle linebacker and captain of the defense. We had Jim Brown as Montezuma, the defensive coordinator. We had Aaron Eckhart as Nick Crozier, the offensive coordinator. We had Bill Bellamy as Jimmy Sanderson, who was a wide receiver. We had Matthew Mondine as Dr. Ollie Powers, who was the team's internist. And we had John C. McGinley as Jack Rose, who was the prominent sports reporter. So looking at that cast list, and obviously there are a whole host of other casts or other actors who appeared in this role. It was a great ensemble cast. What did you make of the cast list as a whole? And was there, if there's anyone that you want to single out and talk about as well, go for it, Dan. We'll get your thoughts first.
I'm a huge fan of sporting cameos by sporting players in their sporting jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have Dick Butkus, Warren Moon, Johnny Unitas, all kind of in the movie, and then have people like Lawrence Taylor play such a pivotal role, I'm a huge fan of that. I think that's great. I also like, it's not Jamie Foxx's most subtle role, but I think he does do, he really brings himself to the role of Willie Beeman, and I really do like that. And Al Pacino is Al Pacino. There aren't bad words to say about Al Pacino.
No.
Really.
Well, I've got quite the alternate history when we get to the sliding doors of who could have played these roles.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to say something bad about Al Pacino, though, but it doesn't necessarily pertain to this movie. It's a reasonable question to ask. Is this his last great role in a movie?
Maybe. I don't know. I'm trying to think of what comes afterwards. So, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I think for me, I think this is the last movie where I was like, oh, Al Pacino, he's really good in this movie. I mean, the only one that springs to mind now, and that's because you mentioned Martin Scorsese before, is his role in The Irishman, which, you know, wasn't a great film and wasn't an excellent performance by Pacino in that one, I would say, in my good opinion. I think elsewhere, I liked Dennis Quaid as Cap. I bought him in that role. And I thought Cameron Diaz knocked it out of the park. I thought she, she obviously did a bit of study and figured out what it was to be an owner. And, potentially in, an alternate universe, she would be a good owner of an NFL team if she brought those character traits to the role. So yeah, they're the ones I like to pick out.
I was gonna say, I also just want to shout out to Aaron Eckhart, because this is one of his early works, and it does feel like, I mean, in my mind, it's the first time that he bursts onto the scene and I go, yeah, he's good. And he's obviously gone on to have a very good career afterwards, but this to me was kind of the first time that we saw that on the big screen.
I think that every actor who was selected for this movie like played their character really well, and like you believe them in each respective character that they played, that they properly sort of like exhibited the sort of qualities that would make this character seem like a real life person as well. I know that some of them were based off other people, but I think that each of these actors really brought their own to a character and made it sort of like authentic, while believing that this particular character could also just live out in the real world as well. And so I think that was really sort of important to get across, the sort of like combined performances of this cast. And so I think that, yeah, I don't think that I can really like say a bad word about anyone. Really, I think that, they just all worked really well together. Every aspect of their character was done really well. I don't really have any bad words to say about any of the actors, really. And so I think that, that's obviously, I think, a testament to how good the cast is and how good that they sort of performed. And I think that as well, like a couple of them, I guess, like you sort of expect like others, you expect like a specific actor to you know, be in certain other movies. And so, like, Al Pacino, for example, like, he relished this role because he found it a refreshing change from the usual cops and gangsters that he usually plays. And so, like, I think that if you can sort of, like, determine that and, like, that sort of point of difference between this movie, like, an actor being in this movie compared to other things that he might be more suited to, or, like, appear to be more suited to, or, you know, selected to play a particular type of role, like, I feel like it is really refreshing to see them in a different light. And I think that, you know, Al Pacino was definitely something that confirmed that.
Yeah, when I was watching this, my girlfriend says to me, Al Pacino, big coach vibes, wouldn't have called that. That's what she said to me. So I think that's a testament to the actor. Al Pacino and Jamie Foxx are definitely the stars of this movie, but it's an incredible ensemble cast that they've put together. You know, and I'm not surprised that we're mostly speaking in glowing terms about the acting performances.
Yeah, I think, like, yeah, as well, like, Al Pacino and Jamie Foxx both won their first Oscars in a year that they were nominated in two acting categories. And not only that, like, they both won for their lead performances. And this film cast includes four Oscar winners. So Al Pacino, Charlton Heston, Oliver Stone, and Jamie Foxx, and then two Oscar nominees as well. And so it is a star-studded, you know, award-winning cast in its own sort of right.
It could have been so different, Jason. May I,
please,
my one bit of study I've done for this podcast,
let me lay casting on you. What ifs.
So I've got the movie ratings, right? And what I want from you guys is when I give the alternate actors for each one, I want to know if you think it would make the rating higher or make the rating lower. Okay. So on Letterboxd, this got a 3.2. IMDb, it was a 6.9. Rotten Tomatoes was 52%. And Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars. Okay. So for Willie Beeman, you can't imagine anyone but Jamie Foxx playing that role, right? It's kind of iconic. It was his breakout role. But there was a whole host of people ahead of him. Will Smith was the first name that Oliver Stone associated with the role, and he had no interest in it. So what do you think, boys? Higher rating or lower rating with Will Smith?
I would have given Will Smith like a lower rating. I think I see Jamie Foxx in this role. I don't think that Will Smith could have delivered as much as a role as Jamie Foxx did.
Dan? Yeah, I'm with Jason on this one.
Yeah? Okay, fair enough. Now, this one, this is kind of funny. Puff Daddy, Sean Combs, was the second person associated with this role. Apparently, the production company was psyched because they were linked in with his record label or something, and they thought it'd be a great opportunity for cross-promotion. He was booted out of the movie, and you can fact check this on the ringer.com's oral history of this movie that speaks to all the major players. They got rid of him when they brought him down to the training camp and saw that he could only throw about 3 yards. So I think we're in agreement it'd be a much lower rating.
Well, although, like, Jamie Foxx is, like, he sort of, like, had a, like, sort of, like, rapping type scene when he was, like, promoting a comic, a product.
Gotta get to work. That's right. I keep the ladies
creaming,
and all my fans
got them screaming.
You can defeat me,
you're dreaming.
But my name is Willie,
with a demon.
I keep the ladies
cold creaming,
and all my fans,
I got them screaming.
If you can defeat me,
you're dreaming.
Inflate your chest, get metrics.
Gotta get to work.
So maybe Puff Daddy could have done that.
Yeah, so we're saying it'd be about the same with Puff Daddy as Steam and Willie Beeman. I'll just run through because there was a lot of names associated with this movie. A lot of people, when they heard Oliver Stone was making a football movie, his big name in the industry, a lot of actors wanted to be a part of it. Ving Rhames was interested in playing Willie Beeman. Cuba Gooding Jr., who, of course, would do a great role in Jerry Maguire. And then just a complete boldie, Tom Sizemore. Read for the role as well, from Saving Private Ryan fame. So, but we'll move on from there. Shark, the role that Lawrence Taylor ended up securing, Michael Clark Duncan from The Green Mile was the first choice for Shark. They got him down to training camp as well and realized that his coordination probably wasn't so great for a football movie, so he missed out. Al Pacino and Cameron Diaz were hired on the spot. Al Pacino was already attached, and Cameron Diaz, as soon as she read for the role, she got it straight away. And the last one I've got here is the role of Cap Rooney, played by Dennis Quaid, was originally offered to George Clooney, and George Clooney knocked it back with the expectation that Oliver Stone would rewrite the role with the notes that he gave him. Oliver Stone did not do that and just moved on to the next one and cast Dennis Quaid. So there you go.
I get the sense that that's a little bit of the MO of Oliver Stone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's his way or the highway.
Yeah, including in the editing room.
100% in the editing room, yes.
Also, like, including, like, himself making a cameo in the film. He played a television announcer, so, like,
yeah.
Himself into the movie too.
Yeah. I think Oliver Stone thinks pretty highly of Oliver Stone, so.
Yeah, well, like, even, like, Oliver Stone, like, thinking highly of himself or, like, thinking of doing, like, things that others might not think that he would do. He was inspired to cast Charlton Heston as the commissioner after he read an interview that Heston gave in which he said, Oliver Stone would never cast me in a movie today. And Oliver Stone did cast him in the movie. I think that's interesting too, because, like, Ben-Hur is the movie on the television when Willie enters Tony's house. And, you know, obviously Charlton Heston stars in that. And Oliver Stone said on the commentary that the meta connection was deliberate and meant to show that yesterday's rebels became the embellishment. Charlton Heston agreed to appear in the film and granted permission for his image in Ben-Hur to be used. However, when Ben-Hur is seen on the TV, scenes are shown in the wrong order.
Too artsy-fartsy. They could have left that out. Mate, that dinner scene could have been so powerful, but instead it was a mess.
Yeah. And Dan, you sort of brought them up before, but, you know, having real American football players. And so the film used Arena Football League players such as Pat O'Hara, who played for the Tampa Bay Storm, later coached the Orlando Predators, and is now an assistant coach with the Tennessee Titans. They also used Connell Minor, who played for the Predators and spent time as both a player and a coach for the Philadelphia Soul. Bjorn Nitmo, who was then with the Buffalo Destroyers, was the Sharks place kicker in the movie. And there's a couple of others as well. I think that you mentioned a lot of the cameo roles as well, such as Johnny Unitas, Warren Moon, Pat Toomey. You know, we mentioned Barry Switzer at the start as well. And so I think that, yeah, it's really cool that they were able to get these players in. And, you know, it just gave a bit more authenticity to how these people could portray American football players, and that they could, you know, they knew what they were doing out on the field and for the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it really does make a difference in things like this, where if you want to, you know, make it be a sports movie, you got to kind of have some sport in there.
Mm. Apparently, running back Darnell Autry auditioned for the film, but he was told that he did not look enough like a football player. I love it when that happens, honestly. Like,
to be fair, have you seen the pictures of Tom Brady at the draft combine?
No.
Oh, those pictures are infamous, because it looks like he's never seen a weight room, let alone been in one at that point in time.
Wow.
And, you know, he's gone on to be Tom Brady, so.
Yeah.
Had a pretty decent career, that bloke.
Oh, her, yeah, her. Just you know, the undisputed GOAT. just that, you know.
All right, we now ask the question, was there a relatable character to you within this movie? And it may be the character as a whole, a certain aspect of them, or maybe it was just a line that the character said that you related to. So, Stewie, we'll go to you first for this one.
I really wish you didn't. Nah, there's not for me in this movie. This is a world I am not familiar with. I don't share any character traits with any of these people, thankfully, for the most part. Don't, like, no hate to the characters. But yeah, not for me. That's a no from me.
All right, Dan.
Look, there's not a lot. There are parts of J-Man, like the bits where he's furious with Willie. Those are the bits that I get, because like that would drive me nuts if I was his teammate.
Mm-hmm.
But really, like beyond that, I think I'm with Stewie in that like there are not a lot of relatable characters in this film.
Well, I agree with both of you as well. Like I didn't really see myself in many of these characters. There was a line that one of the commentators gave though, which was like a deadpan sort of like line about what was happening. And I think like in the whole like shock of everything that was happening in this particular scene, like if I was commentating something and like this happened as well, like I'd probably give the same sort of delivery of the commentator saying, "It looked like he's got damage to his eye." And I was like, I just think like in that moment, I would have just been like too shocked and like said it at that tone as well. Like, yeah, that's all for me.
Graphic scene, that one. Just an eyeball on the pitch. That happen often in football, Dan?
I don't think so. Not really. I think it's a little bit of the dramatic license there.
I'm concerned that that wasn't a firm no. Instead, it was no, I don't think so.
I mean, I haven't exactly, you know, been inside a lot of NFL locker rooms, you know, been on a lot of NFL sidelines in a lot of NFL games. It's hard for me to be too much of an expert on these things.
All right, we are coming up to the end of the movie now, which means that we do ask a prompt. It is, if you could have an American football movie get made, what would it be and why? Dan, we'll get your idea first.
I've got to say, I've been on this podcast like 6 or 7 times, and 5 or 6 of those have been American football movies, and I'm running out of ideas. But I think like one of the things that we're seeing at the moment is that there's this big scandal about Dan Snyder, who owns the Washington Commanders franchise, for a series of your bad behavior over the years. And I actually think a movie on the machinations of the 32 NFL owners deciding to get rid of one of their own for repeated bad behavior and how they manage that kind of gives me really like Suits vibes, like Billions vibes. And maybe that'd be a bit of fun. And you could still mix in the sporting scenes because you got that. But something that's a little bit kind of out there, I think, would be fun and interesting.
I really like that, man. I think that'd be cool. I think you could even leave the football out of it, still talk about it, and just have it focusing on the owners just making this decision to oust one of their own. I'd be there to watch that for sure.
I mean, that said, if someone was going to tell me, look, we're going to make you sell something for $6.5 billion, I probably wouldn't kick in as much of a fuss as he's going to.
All right, Stewie, what's your idea?
So there's a famous Family Guy episode where Peter Griffin goes to play for the London Silly Nannies, an English NFL team. I think Tom Brady appears on the episode and stuff. And maybe just one of those mockumentary, like Mike Bassett, England manager, but about the London Silly Nannies, maybe winning a, cross-Atlantic trophy against an NFL team. Just a comedy. No, I think that would be something funny.
Yeah, nice.
We're really scraping the bottom of the barrel.
My idea relates to, you know, partly like Australian NFL players or like American football players, and partly sort of like exhibition games as well. And so like I did a bit of research in terms of like NFL sort of like going international or like having some games played in different countries as well. And there was one played in Sydney at Stadium Australia a little while ago. And so what my idea, like, you know, isn't exactly like an NFL match, but it's more so an idea of like just maybe getting, you know, all these former Australian NFL high up college level, maybe American football players together and just coming together for some big sort of match or grudge match or something like that. I think that, you know, the opportunities for, you know, cameos are endless there. You know, you can always just have people playing these particular people, but I think that in just like a celebration of all the Australians that have made it to that sort of like level, I think would be really cool to capture in a movie and just give a bit of a sort of like look at, you know, just how much, how many people have made it that far, and just, yeah, be a bit of a celebration in that way.
That's a cool idea, man. I like that. I would watch that too. I just want to ask, Dan, outside of All-Star Games, right, do they have any, like, rep games where they have, you know, nothing like that, just the All-Star Games?
I mean, the problem is that the sport is so brutal that any extra game really has to be worth it, which is why if you ever watch the Pro Bowl, it's really, it's almost touch football. Like, they don't really tackle. No one's breaking tackles or anything like that. It's almost two-hand grab. Mm-hmm. Because the sport otherwise is just so violent. And so they try, like, even now they've reduced the number of preseason games to reduce the kind of stress on people's bodies. So I don't see them ever adding extra exhibition games unless they were going to play like two-hand touch. But then it's a little bit of, what do guys like linebackers do? Because they're not tackling running backs anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gotcha.
All right, well, that does now bring us to an official end for this episode. So, Dan, Stewie, would you like to share your social media handles with us and any other avenue where our listeners can find you?
You can find me at DCoppel, wherever you get your social media fix.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Stewie's Stick of It and TikTok, Stewie the Sports Guy. Same handle on Instagram.
And you can find me on both Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Jace Irves. You've been listening to Goals on Film. You can find Goals on Film on Twitter and Instagram at Goals on Film Pod. Goals on Film is part of the Edge of the Crowd network. You can find Edge of the Crowd on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, and TikTok at Edge of the Crowd. You can also view any of our stories, be it sport, culture, or politics, on our website, www.edgeofthecrowd.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.